Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day to tell you about interesting things that are happening around the world. And we always present these stories in a way that makes them easier to understand if English is not your first language. You will notice that we speak a little slower than normal. We use shorter sentences, and we try to explain words and ideas that may be difficult for you. Today we have information about an international program that helps people be better students. At the same time, it encourages people from different areas and societies to learn more about each other in order to make the world a more peaceful place. To get us started, here are Carva Rezaei and Jill Robbins.
Imagine you are a high school student in Lebanon. A new girl in your neighborhood has just arrived from Syria. You don't have classes with her, but after school, you see kids calling her names and bullying her. Now, imagine you are that Syrian refugee. Your family just escaped from the Islamic State militants. Since school is crowded, you go to school in the afternoon, and Lebanese children go in the morning. They call you stupid because you have not studied French. Sometimes you get so angry that you want to fight with them. Your parents say you should make friends. But how?
This is the problem many nonprofits and international educators want to solve, including Search for Common Ground. Helping different cultures live, work, and learn together is their goal. Elisa Dadi is the country director for Search for Common Ground in Lebanon. She says the Rainbow of Hope project, now in its second year, is giving English lessons to more than 600 children daily in Lebanon after school. Dadi says that
in Syria, it can become very difficult for the Syrian children to enter the Lebanese school, so there is often a separation between the two.
Most Lebanese children learn Arabic and French. Most Syrian children learn Arabic. Some learn a bit of English, too.
But also outside of school, there is very little opportunities for Syrian and Lebanese children to play together and to be children together, so to speak. So we wanted to provide that space for the children of these communities.
Half the children in the program are Syrian, and the other half are Lebanese. Some are Palestinian. At these classes, Syrian children, ages 6 to 11, meet Lebanese children. On weekends, they play games and have fun. They make friends and learn to accept people who are different.
Thank you.
Search for Common Ground also has a program for older youth in Lebanon. It is called Better Together. The program brings young people ages 15 to 25 together in a summer camp. The youth live together and try different arts for a week. Then they choose to produce a play, a video, create music, or make a comic book. They explore the arts and learn life skills in workshops. At the end of the camp, they tour their communities to bring their message to a wider audience.
So the, you know, breaking down of stereotypes, learning how to deal with conflict in a constructive manner, and dealing with the tensions, the coping with a very difficult environment in which these children live in.
Eventually, Dari says, the young people are able to
and deal with the conflict and the tensions in a constructive and collaborative manner, rather than, you know, with hatred and stereotype and adversarial approaches.
NAFSA, the Association of International Educators, recently sponsored an event for nonprofits and educators in Washington, D.C. The event marked the 16th Annual International Education Week. It is called The Role of International Education in Peacebuilding. World Learning and Alliance for Peacebuilding are among the participants at the event. Melanie Greenberg is head of the Alliance for Peacebuilding. She says,
we all have the power to create peace, and I feel it's our responsibility as senior peacebuilders to give students the tools to harness civil society energy and to become leaders themselves.
Greenberg adds that students can learn these four basic building blocks in order to build peace. 1. Understand culture and difference. 2. Learn to listen to other points of view. 3. Act in your own community to make a small change. 4. Connect the local to the global. Like Search for Common Ground, World Learning works with Syrian refugees in Lebanon. The organization helps schools in 300 communities handle nearly 2 million Syrian refugees. They prepare teachers to help students deal with painful memories.
Beyond peace, businesses also want people with cross-cultural skills in a global economy. These include critical thinking, cross-cultural communication, and collaboration skills. For students and others who cannot travel to another country to learn cross-cultural skills, Search for Common Ground organizes online conversations called virtual exchanges. The virtual exchanges are like a video call online. A trained leader guides the conversations of young people from 27 countries. Many come from the U.S. or Western Europe. The others are from Muslim-majority countries like Egypt, Qatar, Yemen, Chad, and Indonesia. Funding from governments and nonprofits will pay for more than 1 million of these virtual exchanges in the next 5 years. Shamil Adris is president of Search for Common Ground. He says, it is good that international education is also supported by businesses.
Those attitudes, skills, and relationships that are critical for peace building also happen to be some of the most critical skills, attitudes, and relationships for employability in today's world.
I'm Kaveh Razai.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Thank you.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. An international court ruled last year that Japan should stop hunting whales in the waters around Antarctica. But Japan is allowed to hunt whales for scientific research. Critics complain that while the Japanese say they are conducting research, they are really hunting whales to sell as meat. In March 2014, the United Nations International Court of Justice ruled that the Japanese whaling program in the waters between Australia, New Zealand, and Antarctica was illegal. The hunt and kill was not scientific research, it says. Japan says catching and killing some whales furthers scientific research. Officials from Australia and New Zealand say calling the work research is a cover-up. Japan argues that the ICJ made its decision based on an older research program that is no longer used. Japan says its new program is much smaller and takes into account the ICJ decision. Japan says it will limit its hunt to 333 minke whales this year, two-thirds fewer than in the past. But this year is only the first year of a 12-year program. That means almost 4,000 whales will be killed over the next 12 years. Australia's Environment Minister Greg Hunt says Japan cannot unilaterally decide whether it has adequately addressed the scientific committee's questions. Alex Gillespie is an international law and conservation professor at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. He says Japan adjusted its whale hunting program since the ICJ did not specifically outlaw hunting whales. Gillespie says the problem is all the scientists who are looking at it are still saying there is no scientific need to do lethal scientific research in Antarctica. Scientists say the Japanese research can be done without killing whales. The meat from these dead whales often ends up in restaurants and on supermarket shelves, but an Australian news outlet reported that whale meat is less popular in Japan than it used to be. A report from the Australian Associated Press news agency in 2014 says whale meat does not sell as well in Japan. And the news agency reported, organizations that protest the whale hunts have helped cut back the catch. I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On April 9, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Union General Ulysses Grant. Within weeks, the Civil War would be over. When people in Washington learned of Lee's surrender, they hurried to the White House. The crowd wanted to hear from President Abraham Lincoln. The speech he gave would be one of his last, as Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe explain this week in our series.
President Lincoln spoke several days after General Lee's surrender. The people expected a victory speech, but Lincoln gave them something else. Already, he was moving forward from victory to the difficult times ahead. The Southern Rebellion was over. Now, he faced the task of rebuilding the Union. Lincoln did not want to punish the South. He wanted to rejoin the ties that the Civil War had broken. So, when the people of the North expected a speech of victory, he gave them a speech of reconstruction instead. On the night of April 11th, Lincoln appeared before a crowd outside the White House. He held a candle in one hand and his speech in the other.
"Fellow citizens," Lincoln said, "we meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart. The surrender of the main army of the Confederacy gives hope of a righteous and speedy peace. The joy cannot be held back. By these recent successes, we have had pressed more closely upon us the question of reconstruction." "We all agree," Lincoln continued, "that the so-called seceded states are out of their correct relation with the Union. We also agree that what the government is trying to do is get these states back into their correct relation. I believe it is not only possible, but in fact easier to do this without deciding the legal question of whether these states have ever been out of the Union. Finding themselves safely at home, it would be of no importance whether they had ever been away."
There was cheering and applause when President Lincoln finished, but less than when he began. The speech had been too long and too detailed to please the crowd. Lincoln, however, believed it a success. He hoped he had made the country understand one thing: the great need to forget hatred and bitterness in the difficult time of rebuilding that would follow the war. The president continued to discuss his ideas on Reconstruction over the next few days. On Friday, April 14th, he agreed to put this work aside for a while. In the afternoon, he took his wife, Mary, for a long drive away from the city. In the evening, they would go to the theater.
One of the popular plays of the time, called Our American Cousin, was being performed at Ford's Theater, not far from the White House. The Secretary of War did not want the Lincolns to go alone. He ordered an army officer to go with them. The President and Mrs. Lincoln sat in special seats at Ford's Theater. The presidential box was above and to one side of the stage. A guard always stood outside the door to the box. On this night, however, the guard did not remain. He left the box unprotected.
President Lincoln settled down in his seat to enjoy the play. As he did so, a man came to the door of the box. He carried a gun in one hand and a knife in the other. The man entered the presidential box quietly. He slowly raised the gun. He aimed it at the back of Lincoln's head. He fired. Then the man jumped from the box to the stage, 3 meters below. Many in the theater recognized him. He was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he hit the stage floor, but he pulled himself up, shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus ever to tyrants, and ran out the door. He got on a horse and was gone.
The attack was so quick that the audience did not know what had happened. Then a woman shouted, "The president has been shot." Lincoln had fallen forward in his seat, unconscious. Someone asked if it was possible to move him to the White House. A young army doctor said no. The president's wound was terrible. He would die long before reaching the White House. So Lincoln was moved to a house across the street from Ford's Theater. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from the president's head. He could not. Nothing could be done except wait. The end was only hours away.
Cabinet members began to arrive, while wild reports spread through the city. The Confederates had declared war again. There was fighting in the streets. An official of the War Department described the situation. The extent of the plot was unknown. From so horrible a beginning, what might come next? How far would the bloody work go? The safety of Washington must be looked after. The people must be told. The assassin and his helpers must be captured.
Early the next morning, April 15th, Abraham Lincoln died. A prayer was said over his body. His eyes were closed. The news went out by telegraph to cities and towns across the country. People read the words but could not believe them. To millions of Americans, Abraham Lincoln's death was a personal loss. They had come to think of him as more than the President of the United States. He was a trusted friend. People hung black cloth on their doors in sorrow. Even the South mourned for Lincoln, its former enemy. Southern General Joe Johnston said, "Mr. Lincoln was the best friend we had. His death is the worst thing that could happen for the South."
Messages of regret came from around the world. British labor groups said they could never forget the things Lincoln had said about working people, things such as, "The strongest tie of human sympathy should be one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues." A group representing hundreds of French students sent this message: "In President Lincoln, we mourn a fellow citizen. There are no longer any countries shut up in narrow frontiers. Our country is everywhere where there are neither masters nor slaves. Wherever people live in liberty, or fight for it. We look to the other side of the ocean, to learn how a people which is known how to make itself free knows how to preserve its freedom. The assassination of Abraham Lincoln touched the imagination of America's writers. Many tried to put their feelings into words. Walt Whitman wrote several poems of mourning. Here is part of one of them. O Captain, my Captain.
Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse, nor will. The ship is anchored, safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead.
Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the spring. That is the time of year when lilac plants burst into flower throughout much of the United States. One of Walt Whitman's most beautiful poems in honor of Lincoln is called When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. Here is part of that poem.
When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac, blooming perennial and drooping star in the west, and thought of him I love. Coffin that passes through lanes and streets, through day and night with the great cloud darkening the land, with the countless torches lit, with the silent sea of faces and the unbared heads, with the tolling, tolling bell's perpetual clang, here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac.
Our program was written by Harold Berman and Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe, and the poems were read by Shep O'Neill. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, plus historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.